Morning, Jack.
Didn't you just have your second-class citizen luncheon? Was it yesterday? Day before.
No, Wednesday.
Wednesday. Mm-hmm. For years, Ray has said that criminals in our country are considered or treated like second-class citizens, those who are the victims. And how many years ago did you start the second-class citizen lunch thing?
Oh, probably 12 years ago.
To actually pay homage to those who are victims of crime.
That's right, and we give them a second-class lunch, too. Everybody comes and gets a hot dog, some chips, a cookie, and a Kmart soft drink.
That's it, huh?
Yeah.
Not even a name brand soft drink.
It's a Kmart soft drink.
K-Cola or whatever.
It is, but it's a cheapo.
Did you have a good turnout?
We had a great turnout.
Good.
And it was, we emphasized property crimes this year, and we had some people who had over $100,000 worth of stuff stolen by somebody that cleaned their house. The person was sentenced to 9 years. Dan Laren prosecuted the case. He was sentenced to 9 years, but guess what? Was probated and only had to serve 90 days and was only ordered to pay $24,000 in restitution. So
it does pay pays.
This woman got a $76,000 gift.
Break, yeah.
Yeah, so there you go. But that was our second-class citizen luncheon.
Tell us what's coming up this morning.
Well, this is an interesting case that I've been watching and watching and watching. It's the Anthony Gray murder case from Scott County, and a young man that I know, Keith Eardley, who at one point was a criminal defense attorney over here before he saw this bright light and decided to go become a prosecutor. Prosecuted this fellow in Scott County. The first trial was a hung jury, meaning they couldn't agree, and that's interesting. And then you have to he retried it, and he convicted the guy, and it's a fascinating case. He killed his parents, and they think that he killed his parents because his parents threatened to disinherit him. So that's what he did. So it's an interesting case and Keith Eardley did an excellent job.
Are there statistics, or I'm sure there are, but do you know the statistics of what your chances are of getting a conviction the second time a case is tried? Do they go up or down?
They have to go down. They have to go down because it's, first of all, it's like retrying a case is like taking a shower in your raincoat. Or sleeping in your socks, it's not the same, and everybody knows what everybody's doing. There are no surprises and that sort of business. So I hate retrying cases, and we're going to have to retry a murder case here, and that was reversed by the Supreme Court for some reason.
Does the jury know it's a retrial?
They're not supposed to, but I can't imagine that they don't.
Okay.
Really.
All right. That's coming up 9 to 10 right here. And good morning. Welcome into the 9 to 10 show. It is 9 after 9, a Forensic Friday, and Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us. And this is American DA Live. Good morning, Ray.
Good morning, Jack.
Brought to you by Landscaper's Corner, 1305 Old Frankfort Pike. Just arrived at Landscaper's Corner. Triple Crown Elite Grass Seed, the grass seed perfected for our area. Call Landscaper's Corner, 859-225-9433. Introduce us to our guest, sir.
When you say good morning, Ray, and I say good morning back, I think about Louie Hillenmeyer, that probably the happiest sounding guy that ever lived, and I come on here sounding like a funeral director.
You sound fine.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
In 2007, a guy named Anthony Gray killed his parents, and that set about a process of charging and investigating and trying this guy over in Georgetown, Scott County. And the fella who is the assistant Commonwealth attorney that's responsible for Scott County is a gentleman by the name of Keith Eardley. Keith Eardley and I became acquainted when he worked for the Lexington Public Defender's Office, and Keith was a very effective trial lawyer, defender. He's got kind of a calm, he's calm and that sort of thing, as opposed to some of us that
are a little on edge.
Yeah. And Keith has come over to what I consider to be the right side, and is doing a heck of a job in Scott County. And Keith was the prosecutor in this Anthony Gray case. Keith, welcome.
Oh, Ray, good morning.
So you decided you didn't care anything about money. You decided you'd just go ahead and be a prosecutor.
Well, well, they pay me, too.
Oh, they do? Well, good.
I'm not
good.
Doing it for free.
Okay, well, that's good to hear.
Tell us a little. So give us a little background on your career. Where did you go to law school, Keith?
I went to law school at the University of Kentucky.
Right.
I graduated in 1998. And after I graduated, I went to work for the Public Defender's Office in Lexington. And I did that for about 8 years. And then I went to work for the Commonwealth Attorney's Office in the 14th Circuit, the Commonwealth Attorney's, Cordy Shaw.
Right.
And we do felony prosecutions in Woodford, Scott, and Bourbon County. So I've been here now for about 7 years.
They have a three-county jurisdiction, whereas... You know, we have one county,
right.
And there are some Commonwealth attorneys that we've had on the show who have a four county, and it's all, I think, based a little bit on population and that sort of thing.
How many work out of your office, Keith?
We have three full-time prosecutors, Gordy Shaw, the Commonwealth attorney, Lee Greenup, and myself, who are both assistant prosecutors, and then we have a part-time prosecutor, Brian Privett, who... helps us here in Scott and Bourbon County.
Tell me a little bit about crime scene.
Very tragic and sad. James and Vivian were both dead. They'd been shot. They had a living room, dining area, and their bodies were both in that area, been shot both in the head and their home. It's a very, tragic situation.
Let me, one of the things that occurs, because in Fayette County, we get the same call and go to these crime scenes. And if somebody like the situation that Keith has described has occurred and the person is dead at the scene, then the coroner and the police leave the body there until they're finished investigating. If in Lexington, and I'm sure in Scott County, the same thing occurs. If there is any potential sign of life, then the emergency people, as they say, scoop them and head for probably the trauma center over here at the University of Kentucky.
How was this crime reported?
A friend of the James and Vivian had come by their house about 8 o'clock in the morning, and she got to the house and the door was unlocked, walked inside and saw James Gray lying on the floor, obviously a lot of blood around his head. She ran out of the house and called 911. So it was reported by a friend of the family that morning.
How old were the two victims in this case?
James was in his early 60s, maybe 62, 63. Vivian was a little younger, in her late 50s.
And okay, so the you're there at the crime scene, and the two victims have been both, I guess, shot in the head.
Right.
Take us through what the investigation. How did that happen?
Well, the first thing that the detectives noticed was that there didn't seem to be any sign of forced entry into the house. The locks weren't broken, window hadn't been broken out, so that stood out immediately. The second thing was they had a lot of valuables in the house, computers, cameras, guns, money, things like that. Nothing appeared to be taken, and the house didn't appear to be ransacked.
So that tells you that it was probably somebody they knew, right?
Yeah, it looked like someone they knew and someone who came to the door and they let him inside. Something else was really important, and that was that James Gray had a loaded pistol in his pocket, a .38 pistol. So whoever it was who shot him, or when Anthony shot him, James didn't have time to reach for his own gun.
Huh. So walk us through the investigation about how that took place and what caused ultimately this Anthony Gray to be charged.
Well, the detectives did a very exhaustive investigation, and they talked to everyone who knew James and Vivian, who might have done this, who had a argument with them, who might have had a motive to kill them. They talked to at least 100 people, and there was a convergence of evidence all pointing at Anthony Gray and what their only son, and what the detectives found out was that shortly before James and Vivian were murdered, they had changed their will. They had taken Anthony, their son, out of the will, and they were leaving everything to their two grandchildren, Charles and Darwin, Anthony's children that he had given up for adoption. The witnesses indicated that they had a handwritten will, and they kept it in their house. And, you know, lo and behold, the one thing that was missing from the house that was never found in the investigation was the handwritten will.
Huh.
So that's when things started to focus on Anthony Gray. The detectives did further investigation and found out from talking to a couple of his old girlfriends that he had talked about killing his parents before. Told a girlfriend back in 2001 that he was thinking about killing them. They could go to the house together. He would go inside and shoot them. They would leave together, and she could be his alibi witness. So, you know, we found out he'd even been talking about doing it. Another thing that was really important in the case was that the detectives interviewed Anthony Gray the day his parents were found and the day after, and they asked him, what do you think might have happened? How could this have happened? Who could have done it? And it wasn't self-evident at first, but in going back through the statement, Anthony Gray gave information about where his parents had been in the house at the time of the murders, which direction they were facing when they were shot. He gave statements about a couple of items of evidence that were found in the house. And in going back through that statement, it appeared that he had intimate knowledge of the crime scene, you know, information that wasn't released to the public and nobody knew outside of law enforcement.
Okay, well, hold that thought. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. Ray Larson, Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson, with us, of course, in the studio this morning. Assistant Commonwealth Attorney from Scott County, Keith Eardley, is on the line. Ray?
Okay, Keith, last thing you were telling us was that Anthony Gray went through when he made a statement, he had information that had not been put out publicly by law enforcement about the crime scene. And isn't that sort of what police do when to test the credibility of witnesses and that sort of thing? If they have information that they shouldn't know unless they're either a participant or have heard from a participant, isn't that kind of the process?
Well, that's very important. And, you know, what the detectives will tell you is they never release information, you know, about the crime scene. That way, when they talk to witnesses or a potential suspect and the person tells them something, it shows whether or not the person has firsthand knowledge or not of what he's talking about. So that, of course, is very, very important.
One of the things that's very important in the whole process of these cases is dealing with survivors of homicide victims. Who were the survivors of the parents who Anthony Gray ultimately was convicted of killing?
Vivian Gray had a large family. She had a sister and several brothers. They were very active, involved in the case. They worked with us closely. James and Vivian also had two grandchildren, Anthony Gray, the defendant's children. Mm-hmm. They had been given up for adoption, and one of the sons worked with us very closely in the case and actually came and testified for us.
One of the Chase Barnett in our office is a victim's advocate with us in some particular cases, and Chase, so Keith has told us who the players are that are the survivors of this murdered couple. Tell us what do victim's advocates do as far as trying to deal with those people and keep them in the mix?
Well, first we would contact the victims and just see what their thoughts are, if they have any questions, and then we would slowly start to work with them through the whole process, you know, setting up for status hearings, different court procedures that they might need to be present for. And we would just be there to answer any type of question that they would have about the whole justice system.
They're really typically people that have never been involved in the criminal justice system are absolutely confused.
Mm-hmm. Because all we know is what we see on TV.
Right.
And it never works that way.
And those of us that are involved in the criminal justice system are sometimes confused.
Let's take a call real quick here. Jim, good morning.
A couple of things. Had the son ever been in trouble with the law? And was the son ever on drugs, or was he druggy? And also one other thing, could there have been done anything to prevent this?
All right, you want to hang up and listen?
Yeah, I'll hang up.
Okay, was the son did he have anything previous, and was he on drugs, and was there anything that might have prevented this?
You know, Anthony Gray didn't have a bad criminal record, and, you know, up until the, you know, around the time when this had happened, I think he had some minor domestic issues. He had never really been in trouble before. He was 38 years old. He, you know, worked as a mechanic. Say no real issues. Regarding drugs, the detectives talked to practically everyone who knew him, and no one said that he had a drug problem. So we don't have any reason to believe that that was an issue.
Any way that this could have been avoided? Anybody? I assume not. Nobody saw it coming, right?
I don't think anybody saw it coming. In fact, James and Vivian Gray, they opened the door and let him come inside.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and we'll be right back. 253-5959. Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson with us in the studio, Chase Barnett, and Scott County Assistant Commonwealth Attorney Keith Eardley. And in the grand scheme of things, Keith, I don't guess this matters, but I'm just curious. Was there any evidence to indicate that when this son came in the door, Anthony Gray, did he come in with his gun pulled, do you think, and immediately killed his parents, or did they have some sort of discussion first? I'm wondering because you said his dad had a gun in his pocket, which makes me think there was some element of surprise.
Yeah, that's a good question. What it looked like happened is Anthony Gray came to the door Tuesday night. They let him in, and they went into the living room, and the father sat on one couch. Anthony Gray sat on another couch, and the mother was sitting in the next room at the kitchen table. Looks like the father got up off the couch, and as he was walking by Anthony Gray, Anthony Gray jumped up and shot him in the back of the head. So
wow.
he shot him back behind the ear.
And the father obviously had no time to react.
Didn't have time to get his gun.
Okay,
I don't even think he saw it coming.
Yeah. Lou, good morning.
Good morning. You've just answered one of my questions. You said right before the break that there was no one saw this coming, and I was concerned when it started out that it had been mentioned that he had this girlfriend or something, and he had told her about his, you know, wanting to kill them, and that she could be his alibi. And unless she was really love-struck or something, I mean, that would scare me out of my jeebies if I was, you know, going with someone and they start about killing their parents, especially if they were supposed to be, quote, normal, unquote. And then the other thing I was going to ask was if it was just a single shot to the head or multiple, because I wouldn't even know exactly where to shoot someone that it would kill them. And, excuse me, I wondered just how he would know that. But I guess you said now something behind the ear. I always think of, you know, they say be careful with the temple if someone falls and hits their head. So I was just wondering about those things.
All right. Well, I'll let you hang up and listen to the answer. What do you say, Keith?
Well, the girlfriend, now this conversation where Anthony Gray said he was thinking about killing his parents happened 5 or 6 years before. And his girlfriend said, I didn't think he was serious. I didn't think he meant it. I asked him if he was serious. He said he wasn't joking, but I still didn't believe him. So the girlfriend who testified about this, I don't think she told anybody else about it, but she said she didn't take him seriously at the time. Regarding the shots, James Gray was shot once behind the ear, and then after he fell face down on the floor, he was shot execution style in the back of the head. Vivian, she was running for the gun cabinet, which was in their dining area, and it looks like she put up her hands to cover her face, and she was shot through both hands and into her head. It looked like the bullet traveled through both hands and then into her head, so just one shot.
Now, when the medical examiner conducts an autopsy, one of the things that they will look for are external wounds. And in certain cases, when people throw their hands up, those are called, and there are injuries on forearms and on hands and that sort of thing, those are called defensive wounds that are obvious that people are trying to avoid something. Keith, so this guy was arrested ultimately, and was it as what was it that caused him to be arrested? And then we're going to get into a couple of trials here.
Yeah, he was locked up in jail on another charge for about 30 days while the investigation was ongoing. And while he was locked up in jail, he told another inmate he had killed his parents, told him how he did it, told him he was going to have all this money when he got out, said he thought the cops were stupid, they thought he was at work when it happened. And this inmate came forward on his own and said, this is somebody's family, law enforcement needs to know what happened. So not being promised anything, he came forward and did the right thing and informed the sheriffs, hey, this guy told me he killed his parents, you need to know. The sheriffs interviewed him a day or two after that. They told him, Anthony, we know you killed your parents. They bluffed him. They said, we've got you on video in your car driving over there. We've got blood on your clothes. We got blood in the car. We know you did it. And Anthony Gray said, you're right. I did it. It was an accident. I didn't mean to do it. Then they arrested him.
Huh. Okay, so he's arrested and charged with multiple murder. Let's talk about, because this thing was, you had to try it twice.
That's right.
So tell me about the first trial ended up in a hung jury, which
right.
means that the jury could not, it has to be a unanimous verdict.
Right.
And somebody or more wasn't convinced, right?
Right.
Did anybody ever suggest why?
Well, what had happened, you know, of course, when you go into a trial, you never know what the defense is going to argue. And we didn't know going into trial if he was going to argue that it was he didn't do it, he was not guilty. We thought he might argue, this isn't murder, this is manslaughter. I did it, but I was in this heightened emotional state. So, of course, going into trial the first time, we didn't know what the defense was going to do. They argued, of course, that he didn't do it. Regarding his confession, he said the police had threatened him, told him, you better say you did it or you're getting the death penalty. And the defense also, we had come to the conclusion that he had murdered his parents Tuesday night, and the defense argued that the murders didn't happen Tuesday night. They happened Wednesday afternoon, and Anthony Gray had an alibi for Wednesday afternoon. So that was their defense at trial.
Okay, and somebody on the jury had some was not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt, And as a result, one or more of them said, I'm not convinced. And so it was basically a hung jury.
That's right. Right.
What happens with the defendant between trials in that situation?
He stayed in custody, so he didn't go anywhere. He was in jail before. He was in jail waiting for the second trial.
How long was it between the two trials?
It was about a year.
Chase has a question for you, Keith.
Okay.
Did anything come out during the trial about Anthony Gray's mental state?
The defense asked about that. They asked him whether or not he had any mental health problems. His answer was no. They also brought out through Anthony Gray that, well, there was nothing wrong with him. So that did come out.
Okay, thank you.
We're taking a break. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. Now, retrials, we talked a little bit about this off the air and a little bit on the air, Keith, before you came on with us this morning. This is Keith Eardley, Assistant Commonwealth Attorney in Scott County, and Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson is with us, along with Chase Barnett from his office. And Ray, you were saying that nobody wants a retrial. I mean, no prosecutor wants to have trial cases twice.
Right? Well, you gear up for the first trial. And, Keith, you can either agree or disagree with this, but you gear up for the first trial and everything. And then when you have to try to gear up again, there's not the same pizzazz involved in it. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Well, it depends on the case. This time, going into the first trial, as I said before, we didn't know if the defendant was going to argue manslaughter or that he was not guilty. Going into the trial the second time, we had already seen their playbook. We knew that they were going to argue not guilty, and we knew that his defense was going to be that the murders happened on Wednesday when he had an alibi, not on Tuesday night when we believed it happened. So, as I say, we had seen their playbook, and we were ready for it. So we were excited about trying it the second time because, we were confident.
How did you overcome the Tuesday versus Wednesday allegation?
We went back through every single piece of evidence and every witness who had anything relevant to say about the issue. And we put on all the evidence that suggested Tuesday, showed Tuesday, the telephone records, the Tuesday's newspaper sitting out on the coffee table, the mail when it was delivered. We went back, as I say, through all the witnesses who were by their house on Tuesday and Wednesday. We were very exhaustive in the process. So we showed the jury everything we had.
Did you ever find the murder weapon? Was it ever recovered?
No, the defendant threw it out of his car.
What was the weapon? Do you remember?
It was a .45 caliber handgun.
Wow, boy, that's a big
that's a cannon. Yeah.
Okay, so how long did the second trial take, Keith?
Altogether, it was 2 weeks.
You know, Jack, you people have no idea how exhaustive a trial can be. You have to concentrate on every word that's said, and you got all kind of planning going on. The victim's advocates are busy trying to keep the families informed and all that sort of thing. So a 2-week trial is a long trial. So Keith, you put the case on. How long was the jury out the second trial?
I think they were out about 8 hours. It was quite a while.
Well, so and walk us through the thought process of a prosecutor when you got a pretty much a slam dunk case, and all of a sudden the jury's out for 8 hours, and you're thinking, my gosh, what's going on?
And the second trial at that, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we had almost 2 weeks of proof in the case, and there was a lot to talk about. And the jury heard the defendant's confessions. They heard from dozens of witnesses. They read letters that we introduced from the defendant, saw videos. There was a lot of information for them to process. So I would have been I would have been surprised if they had come out quickly. No, I think the jury did their job, and I'm glad they took a long time to review through all the evidence because it showed me that they considered everything.
Did they ask for any additional information during their when they were deliberating?
We had introduced a news clip where the defendant had talked on TV the day his parents were found. They wanted to see that again. They wanted to see his confession again, and there was a phone call made from the jail they wanted to hear again. So they asked to review that evidence again.
One of the things that telephone calls from the jail are, at least in Fayette County, and I'm assuming in Scott County, there's a thing that comes on a recording that says this telephone call is recorded. And you'd be surprised how many people just tell it all right there.
It happens. I've learned that just on the show. And I've also learned how many people can't keep their mouth shut to another prisoner. How many people confess to another prisoner while they're in jail. It's amazing. Is it just they can't, they got to share that with somebody? What's the psychology behind that? Because that's stupid.
Well, people want to talk.
Yeah.
And people want to talk. And it's, you know, this is nothing new. And this isn't the first time somebody has got themselves in trouble by talking too much.
Well, that's for sure.
Yeah. I want to really give credit to the Scott County Sheriff's Office. They spent years listening to all of Anthony Gray's phone calls. There were hundreds and hundreds of hours. They listened to everything, and they analyzed every word he said. They did a great job on top, great job on that.
We got 2 minutes left. We got the verdict. It was guilty in the second trial. What about the sentencing?
The jury recommended 45 years, and the judge accepted that recommendation and sent him to prison.
So that's where he is now. Because you had two victims here.
Right.
How did they differentiate the two victims in their verdicts?
They gave 20 years for James. They gave 20 years consecutive for Vivian, and they gave him 5 years for tampering with physical evidence. That's for throwing away the gun. So they gave him 45 years, and that's how they broke it down.
That wasn't a death penalty eligible case.
It was a death penalty eligible case. However, in meeting with the family, with our victim's advocate, Debbie Birdwhistle, although the family, several of them, wanted the death penalty, they were all in agreement that Vivian wouldn't want Anthony to get the death penalty. So it was at the family's request that we took death off the table.
Well, that happens on occasion, and that's obviously what happened. In this case, Keith, so tell us how you like being a prosecutor.
Oh, I like it very much. I work with great people. My fellow prosecutors are wonderful to work with. We have a great team here. I'm very pleased.
Appreciate very much you being with us. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Keith. We'll see you.